Same thing if you're trying to heal from, if you have chronic back pain or IBS, you might try a couple different treatments. And when they don't work, you assume that the treatment was flawed and you try a new treatment. Now, in our culture with mental health treatment, you go and get treatment. And if it doesn't work, you blame yourself. And one of the problems with this is that I can give anybody treatment that feels good. I can be validating. I can reflect back what you say. I can be complimentary. You will leave a therapy session with me feeling good. I enjoyed talking to Aaron. That is not the same as your trauma going away and your PTSD nightmares going away. That's not the same as your grief going away. That's not the same as your depression going away. And that's not the same as your eating disorder going away.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Aaron Parks, a clinical psychologist, researcher, and former director at the UC San Diego Eating Disorder Center. Aaron is currently the chief clinical officer and co-founder of Equip, a telehealth platform for eating disorder treatment. In this episode, Aaron covers the basics of data-driven eating disorder treatment and barriers to access. She advocates for family-based treatment, an approach that involves a patient's entire support system and prioritizes their lived experience. Here's our conversation. Well, welcome, Aaron. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
I'm so excited to be here, Christine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to our conversation today. I want to learn everything about eating disorder and how Equip is addressing this problem. I mean, I read it somewhere that it's like the number of population in the U.S. who are impacted by eating disorder, I think it's close to 30 million. People will have eating disorder in their lifetime. And the cost to the healthcare is ginormous and to the society. $65 billion. I did not know.
Well, yeah. And I think when people hear 30 million people with eating disorders, they're like, I don't know that many people with eating disorders. But we tend to just think of thin, white, cis female women between the ages of 15 and 25. But we know that actually who gets eating disorders is so much wider than that. And right. When you learn that, you're like, okay, of course it's 30 million people.
Yeah. So I thought before we start, it's always great to hear your story, how you end up choosing this field. I mean, I cannot imagine when you were born, like, I'm going to address this eating disorder problem.
No, not at all. So I don't know. My first job out of college was marketing Broadway shows while they were touring. So I wasn't even in the mental health space. But I had a really awesome roommate who had reminded me, she's like, all through college, all that you ever talked about was public health issues. Like, this is what you're passionate in. Why are you marketing Broadway shows? And I am a bit of a type A. I really enjoy Excel spreadsheets and numbers and research. And so I made a pretty dramatic pivot into neuroimaging research. So I moved from Chicago to Washington, D.C. and did neuroimaging research at the NIH. Did that for a couple of years and then applied to grad school. And I loved being a neuroimaging researcher, and the research funding landscape can shift kind of dramatically depending upon the administration and funding. And I also knew that I wanted to become a parent. So I was eager to kind of explore what other career options would look like. And I ended up off cycle for fellowship after I gave birth to my first son. And so I asked a couple of friends, do any of you know anyone hiring fellows off cycle? And they're like, oh, Dr. Walt Kay at the UC San Diego Eating Disorder Center has a fellowship open. You should go check it out. And I was like, eating disorders? Like, that doesn't sound like fun. And I have to admit that my judgment is the judgment of most people who've gone through school. So I was now a clinical psychologist by training, and I'd received zero training in eating disorders. And most people who finish their degrees and become pediatricians or dietitians or therapists really receive little to no education on eating disorders, except I was told to avoid them, that it's not a fun group to treat.
So, why is that?
I mean, eating disorders continues to be the black sheep of the mental health field. So we have come really far. It used to be if your child had like even autism, schizophrenia, we would blame the parent. But we now recognize those as brain-based illnesses. And even substance use has come a really long way culturally in us recognizing all of the systemic, biological, sociocultural factors that contribute to substance use disorder and how it is a brain-based illness. But eating disorders, still the place where we blame the person who's ill, we blame their parents. My hunch is because almost all of us can relate to having not liked our body at one point in time, having succumbed to diet culture and tried to alter our bodies. And so I think we sometimes conflate not liking our bodies with an eating disorder. And it's the same mistake we make if you conflate being sad with having major depressive disorder, right? Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't say like, well, I was sad once, but I still went to work. Why aren't you able to get out of bed?
Right.
Well, being sad and depression are different things. Same thing, not liking your body and having an eating disorder, while related, are also different things. So there's a lot of blame. And because of that, eating disorders are the least funded of all mental health disorders. But they're the least funded philanthropically, but they're also the least funded for federally research dollars as well. We give about 75 cents per patient for federal research dollars. The next least funded is $75 per patient. So it's very much the under-recognized area. So I was told don't go into eating disorders, did it anyways, learned so much. I absolutely loved being at UC San Diego. They have one of, if not the best eating disorder program in the world, received outstanding training, but also became really interested in what I call the business of mental health, which is how do we keep our doors open? You're only able to help people if you're also able to make sure that you are well-funded and that you have a revenue model that allows you to keep your doors open. And so while I was there, I became interested in the business of mental health, learned how to treat eating disorders, and became really aware of the ways in which the eating disorder treatment landscape is broken. People were traveling from all over the world to get treatment at the UC San Diego Eating Disorder Center. Mm-hmm. And our treatment was great, but it wasn't a secret. It was truly just evidence-based treatment. And so why were people not having access to evidence-based treatment in their own backyards? And at the same time, my now co-founder, Christina Safran, had founded Project Heal and was really focused on the financial access issue, helping to raise money to send people to treatment who could not afford it. And over 3-4 years, we just constantly talked about this access issue. And we both kind of agreed that the key to solving this was the payers. So oftentimes it is the payers, be it Medicaid or TRICARE or commercial insurance companies, that are maligned in this discussion. Like it's the insurance companies who didn't authorize treatments, the insurance companies who are causing these high out-of-pocket expenses. But we really saw them as the solution. And how could we help consumers and payers differentiate between treatment that feels good and treatment that actually works? So to kind of wrap up this long story, I never thought I'd leave academia. I loved academia. And it just became very clear that academia wasn't going to be nimble enough in order to solve this big problem. And also Christina was realizing that nonprofit wasn't going to be capitalized enough to solve this problem. And so we went and raised venture capital. And here I am in my 40s at a startup, like something I never imagined before, but I'm happy as can be.
Oh, that's great. I want to go back to a bit about what you mentioned, that UC San Diego is really good because of the evidence-based kind of treatment. What are the things that make it as a great center for everybody who wants to come there and to get treatment? Because it can be a chronic condition, or it is a chronic condition that you have to manage.
Right. Well, for some, eating disorders are fully curable. I'm going to use the word curable condition. If you get good treatment, you can fully recover from an eating disorder. It does not need to be chronic, but you're right. For like 30-40% of people, it ends up being a chronic condition because they don't have access to treatment that works. So to briefly like get on my treatment that works soapbox, I feel like mental health is the one area where we are hesitant to point our finger at treatment and say the treatment didn't work. So as an example, I'm just going to do like a masseuse. If you had someone that you went and got massages from and they were so nice and you loved talking to them, but the massages really made your back hurt, you would stop going to them. It didn't matter how nice they were. You would recognize that the intervention they were giving you wasn't effective. Same thing if you're trying to heal from, if you have chronic back pain or IBS, you might try a couple different treatments. And when they don't work, you assume that the treatment was flawed and you try a new treatment. Now, in our culture with mental health treatment, you go and get treatment. And if it doesn't work, you blame yourself. And one of the problems with this is that I can give anybody treatment that feels good. I can be validating. I can reflect back what you say. I can be complimentary. You will leave a therapy session with me feeling good. I enjoyed talking to Erin. That is not the same as your trauma going away and your PTSD nightmares going away. That's not the same as your grief going away. That's not the same as your depression going away. And that's not the same as your eating disorder going away. So what we have right now are, I would say, a huge problem. We have probably tens of thousands of therapists who are very big-hearted, but they're giving treatment that feels good, not treatment that works. And so then when that happens, you as a consumer of mental health treatment, you blame yourself. You don't say that nice woman, Erin, that I talked to is the reason my depression isn't getting better. You think, I'm broken. My depression is so bad that even that nice therapist, Erin, couldn't make it better. My trauma is untreatable because even Erin couldn't make it better. And that is something that I really hope as a society we can flip on its head and recognize that when you're getting mental health treatment and you don't get better, it's not your fault. It's the treatment's fault. And this would force treatment centers, treatment providers, and insurance companies to really differentiate between treatment that feels good and treatment that actually works. So what is UC San Diego doing? They're doing the evidence-based treatment for eating disorders, which is called FBT or family-based treatment. It's what we also do at EQIP. They also do it at UC San Francisco and at Stanford, Columbia. A lot of the different academic medical centers utilize it. And it doesn't feel good at all, but it does work and it makes the eating disorder go away.
And what make it work that doesn't make you feel good?
What makes it work is you bring in your whole family. So just think, most teenagers, I would say 100% of teenagers, they don't want to get treatment for their eating disorder, but they really don't want to get treatment with their family. That's really normal. As a teenager, you want to differentiate from your parents. That being said, the treatment that works is bringing in your whole family. So you can think about it kind of from a substance use standpoint. If you thought that your 15-year-old was struggling with using substances, when your 15-year-old goes to soccer practice, you should go and search their bedroom. Is there substances hidden in the closet? Are there substances underneath the bed? The same thing is true with eating disorders. So family-based treatment for eating disorders means that we task the adults in the situation. Oftentimes this is the parents, but it's also been step parents and dad's girlfriend and foster parents and aunts and uncles and grandparents. So whoever the non-mentally ill adult is in the home, we task them with structuring the home for pro-health behaviors or recovery behaviors. So if you think your child is vomiting after dinner, then it becomes a family rule that after dinner, you have to stay where I can see you. You could have unlimited screen time, but I need to be able to see you. No taking a shower after dinner, no going and being alone in your room after dinner. Mm-hmm. As the healthy member of the family, you're going to structure your home to make it difficult for them to act on their urges. Mm-hmm. And that's really at the crux of family-based treatment. Now, why is it not feel as good? Well, the teenager usually doesn't want their parents participating. As parents, we care. I'm a parent myself. We care about our child's health and we care about our child's education, but we also care about our relationship with our child. And so it feels like, oh, they're already sick with an eating disorder. They're already missing school because of an eating disorder. The only thing I have left is my relationship with them. I should preserve my relationship, not participate in treatment. And we know that the reverse is true. It's going to be better for your relationship in the long run and your child will get better if you do participate. But yeah, it's uncomfortable because we sit there and say, hey, parents, they need to be eating 3,000 calories a day. And it looks like they only ate 2,000 yesterday. Why is that? Well, we were running late and didn't have a chance to really make dinner. So we were just grazing. Be like, food is medicine for your child right now. And so how are you going to make sure your child gets that 3,000 calories a day? Those are hard conversations to have. Not nearly as fun as just reflective listening and being validating.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned about kind of bring the whole family together. And I was talking to somebody else, not about the mental health, even for diabetic patient. A lot of the treatment tend to focus on the patient. but it's so important to bring the family together, because if you want to change the diet, it's hard for one person to change diet. But then if you bring the whole family, it will make a better impact. So it's interesting.
It's completely true. Yeah. Well, and if you also think about it, having a mental illness is already so isolating. If you're depressed, if you have PTSD, if you have an eating disorder, by making people do individual treatment, it's another way that you're emphasizing this isolation. Instead of saying, no, let's bring in the whole family to help get you better. It's kind of like if your loved one was going through cancer treatment, you wouldn't have them go to chemotherapy by themselves. You'd go with them and you'd watch a movie and you'd rub their back and you'd try to make this hard thing easier. And the same thing should be true for mental illness. You should bring your whole family, and then your family will help you to do the things you need to do, be it change your diet in the case of diabetes, make you get out of bed when you don't want to, when you're depressed or grieving, or if you have an eating disorder, make it difficult to act on your eating disorder urges.
And so I'm going to ask you about how EQIP is addressing that using the evidence base that what you've been practicing at UC San Diego, put it in EQIP. Can you talk more about what's the cause of eating disorder? I was talking to somebody, it's not so much about the image, because usually you just like, how could you have eating disorder if you're already looking pretty thin already? But somebody was saying it's all about control. And so, you know, everybody has different theory, obviously.
Yeah. Well, so one thing that'd be great for everyone to know is that there are actually 5 different types of eating disorders. So an eating disorder is an umbrella term. I think most of us think about anorexia when we think about eating disorders. And oftentimes, but not always, in anorexia, people will appear emaciated or severely underweight. That being said, there's a lot of people with anorexia who will be at what's considered an average weight. It's just not the weight that their body wants to be at for them. We know that in anorexia and in other eating disorders, many of the symptoms of an eating disorder are actually the symptoms of being in a starvation state. I love to tell the story of the Minnesota Male Starvation Study. I'm from Minnesota originally, but that's not why I like the study so much. But it happened in the 40s. There was a group of Mennonites who were conscientious objectors to the war. And so the U.S. government said, okay, we won't make you enroll in the draft, but you have to instead participate in this research study at University of Minnesota that will last an entire year. And the government wanted to find out what is the best way to refeed people following a period of famine. So they knew from World War I that oftentimes during war, you'll have whole populations of people that would become underweight and not have access to food. So what's the best way to refeed people? So they took this group of men. All of them had no mental health history, no physical health history, and let them do whatever they want for the first 12 weeks. And then they started systematically starving them. And as each man lost weight and became underweight for their specific body, they started experiencing increased anxiety, increased depression, an obsession with food, cutting recipes out of the newspaper. When they would get food to eat, they would manipulate it and make strange concoctions or cut it into really small pieces. One person cut one of their fingers off. Basically, just the act of being in a starvation state induces mental illness. And so what unfortunately has been happening in eating disorder treatment is I'm going to take a single patient, see them individually, and I'm going to convince them to eat. I'm going to convince them that they're beautiful. That doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because as long as you're still in the starvation state, you're going to have that anxiety, that depression, the eating disorder thoughts. So what you actually have to do is restore someone's weight first, and then the brain heals. So it's kind of like you would never do individual therapy with someone while they were drunk, trying to convince them to stop drinking. Same thing. You can't do individual therapy with someone while they're in a starvation state to convince them to stop starving. So that's where the family comes in and helps to refeed them. And then the brain heals as a result of that.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
And how do you address, so it makes sense for adolescent because you have the parents, but adults also have the eating disorder. And how do you bring that their family to be part of it?
Great question. Yes. So most eating disorders do start in childhood. So the newest eating disorder is called ARFID, Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. That usually starts in toddlerhood.
Toddlerhood.
Yeah. So we treat kids as young as 6 at EQIP who are struggling with ARFID.
What is ARFID?
ARFID, I mean, I'd like to call it picky eating gone awry, but the ARFID experts would say, no, it's too simplistic. So we see kind of 3 different types of ARFID presentations. One is this extreme limited palate. They're kids who are 12 years old and only eat 5 foods. Applesauce, one of the Doritos. Yeah. So they just, sometimes it's a texture issue. Sometimes it's a taste issue, but they're just having a really hard time expanding their palate. Usually what we hear from their parents is, I've been telling the pediatrician since they were 3. My kid's picky, like something's wrong. And they hear, oh, picky eating's normal. Right. They'll grow out of it. And then when they're 11, the pediatrician's like, you're right. This is abnormal. Go get help. Well, what we'd like is for more people to know about ARFID so their child can get help when they're 6 instead of waiting until they're 11 or 12. Another type of ARFID is a phobia. So they're afraid of choking on the food or afraid of having an allergic reaction or afraid of vomiting. And then another type of ARFID is just having very, very low hunger cues. They're never hungry. And then even after just 1 or 2 bites, they're full and their stomach might even hurt. So those are like the different presentations of ARFID. That being said, we treat adults with ARFID because it's a new diagnosis, which means people have had it for their whole lifetime and just didn't know what was wrong. Anorexia tends to start around puberty. Bulimia and binge eating disorder tend to start around young adulthood, 18 to 25. Okay, so what do you do though when you're an adult? So we bring in whatever supports are in their life. So that's been siblings, best friends, spouses, girlfriends and boyfriends, roommates, and help them to bring in someone else. Now, if they don't have anyone else they can bring in, well, then that's the very first treatment target we work on. How are we going to expand your support system? Because you can't go through life having 0 people to rely on, right? So are you going to reconnect with your sister? Are you going to reconnect with your parent? How are we going to create some supports for you? And then we'll bring those supports in.
Okay. So how do you translate that, the one-on-one in person? And I think that's what EQIP comes in, that can expand the access to these experts.
So EQIP, the startup that we founded in December of 2019. So we started it even before COVID. We had this 100% virtual treatment model. And what we're trying to do is take these treatments that have been kind of stuck in academia and bring them to the whole population so that you don't have to go to UC San Francisco or Columbia or UC San Diego to get evidence-based treatment. I mean, certainly if you live there, you should go there. But if you live in Iowa, you shouldn't have to fly across the country to get treatment. And so we give every family a 5-person treatment team. So they get a dietitian, a therapist, a physician that can both monitor for medical stability, which is important because eating disorders are the 2nd deadliest of all mental health illnesses right after opioid addiction, but it can also prescribe medication. We give everyone a peer mentor. That is someone who is in recovery themselves. And then we give everyone a family mentor. That is someone who has helped their loved one through an eating disorder, who's there to mentor your family members. All of this care is 100% virtual. And this allows a couple things. One, it allows us to serve more people. You don't have to travel for treatment. But another important aspect of being virtual is that treatment should fit your schedule instead of you rearranging your life for treatment. We really believe that you need to build a life worth living. You need to have things in your life that are more important than and bigger than your eating disorder, than your depression, than your grief, in order to get you to keep going. Now, that's not going to happen if you can't go to soccer practice because you have to go to group therapy, and you can't go to Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts because you have a dietitian appointment, and you can't participate in the school play because you have to go to this IOP after school. So the idea of EQIP is that we can work around your schedule and you can always access treatment. The last thing that's nice about the virtual model is you can bring your entire village. recovering from an eating disorder is difficult. Most of our patients need to eat 3,500 calories per day, every single day, just to gain 1 pound per week. And oftentimes you need to tag in, yeah, neighbors and aunts and best friends. And if you're doing kind of what we call brick and mortar treatment, if you're driving someplace for treatment, you can't bring your whole village. I've got two little kids and I lean heavily on my mother and my brother and my sister to take care of them. And I couldn't have all of them show up at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday and navigate Southern California traffic and find parking. But with virtual, you can bring your whole village into treatment.
And so is that because I mean, when you do virtual, but then you still have to schedule it with that person who's meet with, I assume it's a one-on-one virtual meeting because it's not a robot that they are available at all times. How does that work?
Yes, we have no robots right now at Equip. So we have a secure telehealth platform where you do all of your scheduling of appointments, schedule at the times that work for you. You meet one-on-one or family with one provider at a time. We do have classes and groups available for people who would like that or need that extra support. You also have unlimited sessions. So what you need 1 week might be different than what you need another week. So for instance, we had a family who would meet with their dietitian every Tuesday. It was really helpful. But then they decided, I need to go camping. COVID is driving us nuts. We need to get outside of the house. So on Thursday, they sent a message. So our platform allows you to do unlimited between session messaging with your providers, sent a message to the dietitian and said, help, like, what do I pack for camping so that he can eat 3,500 calories a day? Mm-hmm. So the dietitian said, let's get on a quick check-in tomorrow morning. We'll make your grocery list together. And so the parent and the dietitian had a 15-minute check-in the next morning, made a grocery list, and then they hit the grocery store on their way out of town. So this is an example of how the platform allows you to kind of titrate up and down what you need. You go through a breakup, you might need an extra session with your therapist. You're having a great week, you might meet with your team a little bit less so that you can enjoy the life that you're building.
That's great. So how is it this Equip platform, if say somebody who lives close to UC San Diego or UCSF, and if, you know, it sounds a bit more convenient than even being going, you know, to look for parking in Parnassus can be a pain. How is it different? I mean, if you have that access, do you combine it or?
Why would you do one or the other? Yeah. So for instance, at UC San Diego, they offer partial hospitalization and IOP. So that's day treatment and IOP. So even IOP is 3 hours a day, 3 to 5 times a week. They don't offer outpatient care. So Equip is outpatient care. So what we see for people in San Diego is they might leave a treatment center like UC San Diego and then step into Equip. Other people might make the choice to try Equip instead of trying a higher level of care. For instance, Stanford inpatient is one of our top referral sources. So people go straight from inpatient treatment at Stanford to treatment at Equip. I think right now we're seeing also a lot of wait lists at the in-person treatment. You know, COVID is definitely reducing the number of patients that can be treated at any given time. So I think that's another reason why people are choosing Equip right now too, is that we have no wait lists. People are able to start right away instead of oftentimes there's 3 or 4 month wait lists at many different places.
Do you guys do a validation study to see whether your platform, it works? And how well it works compared to in person?
Yeah. So we like to say that all of the ingredients of the pie were validated and we're baking the pie. So there was a randomized control trial comparing FBT, that's the name of our treatment, family-based treatment, FBT, FBT delivered in person compared to FBT delivered via Zoom or via telehealth. And it works just as well, whether it's delivered via the computer or in person. There also was an FBT randomized controlled study showing that it worked just as well, whether the teenager comes to treatment or not, or if it's just with the parents. So all of these different components have been validated. Peer mentorship's been validated as well. But this is the first time that it's all happening together at once. Right now, if you were to go to a FBT therapist, it would usually be just you and a therapist. You don't have, like, there wasn't an avenue for family mentors or peer mentors. Insurance companies weren't going to pay. That was an area that hadn't been professionalized. So I think that's a big way in which EQIP is also changing the treatment landscape, is professionalizing this lived experience and the way that they can help give practical advice to people going through eating disorder treatment.
And I'm going to ask you, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are entrepreneurs, the idea of engaging a payer is so important. And you guys get paid by the payers. Like, what was the process? What do you have to show in order to get that kind of validation?
I mean, I would encourage everyone to make sure that they are engaging with payers, because that's the only way to truly have access. So we're working both with commercial payers. We're in network with Optum, Horizon, and Cigna. But we also have been engaged with Medicaid payers, and it's definitely our North Star to make sure that everyone in the U.S. has access to eating disorders, whether they're utilizing TRICARE or Medicaid or a commercial payer or an employee plan. So I think everyone should pursue it. I think what needs to be shown to payers is, what is the size of the problem? What is the problem costing them? And how are you going to improve outcome for their patients? Payers were really familiar with the difficulties that were happening in the eating disorder treatment landscape. They were watching their members cycle in and out of different treatment centers and not get better. They were also aware that there were a few places doing really, really good work, like the different universities I'd mentioned, and hadn't figured out how can we make sure our entire panel is having the same results that we're seeing at just a few centers. So I think really combining certainly your financial proposition, but what they really also care about is their members getting better and showing them how you measure improvement and what the expectations should be. I think the other great thing about engaging payers is this is an exciting time to be talking about risk sharing and different value propositions, especially for illnesses where people are going to take more than a few weeks to recover, and how we are helping to certainly improve the financial spend on that patient over a period of time, but really also how can we improve that patient's quality of life? Because especially for kids, if your kid is sick, you're not changing jobs and you're not changing insurance companies. So they know that they're responsible for that child for another 10 years. So how can we be building this pro-health member early on? So there's a lot of long-term value in working with payers.
And also as employer, when your child is sick, is your productivity come down? And so this is something that definitely they understand the challenge.
Yes. And you're right. You know, when we look at caregiver burden and also parent self-efficacy, the more efficacious that parents are feeling, the more likely it is their child will have a full recovery. And then the inverse is true with burnout. The more burnt out the parents are, the less likely their children are to recover. And so by giving someone, by equipping them with a 5-person team, it helps to really reduce that burnout.
No, this is great. Well, thank you so much for sharing with me about the eating disorder and what you're addressing. You're doing, you know, great work. I'm so excited.
Thank you for having me, Christine. Yeah, I'm so excited to have this conversation and to help spread the awareness that, you know, eating disorders is something that, one, affects everybody of all genders and races and body sizes, but 2, is 100% curable, and that we should be demanding that we get treatment that works.
So and you don't hear much about it. It's because people don't talk about it.
No one talks about it. Yep. It's almost like people talk about their anxiety now. It's almost cool to be anxious. We're all anxious, right?
Yeah.
But we don't talk about eating disorders. And I think a lot of people really struggle with eating disorder behaviors, and we're glad to be there to help people.
This is great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.